high school guidance counselor used to ask us what you would do if you had $1 million, didn't have to work. And then invariably, whatever you'd say, that was supposed to be your career. So if you wanted to fix old cars, then you're supposed to be an auto mechanic.
So what did you say?
I never had an answer. I guess that's why I'm working at Initech.
No, you're working at Initech because that question is bullshit to begin with. If everyone listened to her, there'd be no janitors because no one would clean up if they had $1 million.
If I had $1 million. If I had $1 million.
Talking about millions of dollars.
What would you do if you had $1 million?
I'll tell you what I'd do, man. Two chicks at the same time, man.
We're living in a material world and I am a material girl. Or boy.
Well, what about you now? What would you do?
Besides two chicks at the same time?
Oh, yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing, huh?
I would relax. I would sit on my ass all day. I would do nothing.
Well, you don't need $1 million to do nothing, man. Take a look at my cousin. He's broke, don't do
If I had $1 million. If I had $1 million.
Hello and welcome back to Stacks and Jacks. I'm Tim Howe, Andrew on the board. S&P futures are up 25 cents. NASDAQ futures are down 225 after a run-up yesterday. Big turn on the NASDAQ. They were down 120, the futures, when I was doing the show. And all of a sudden, they finished up over 200. So, I mean, that's a big move. It's a 300-point move. Do we have Kevin and Lou, I hope?
Yeah, good morning, guys.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, sir.
Andrew, can you throw my volume up a hair? Get a load of this. We're walking in the fire department downstairs. Pretty much all good guys, right? You guys, it's amazing the morning, the choreography, because the shift changes right here at like 6 o'clock. But nobody wants to park anywhere where they have to pay, right? So they have to have a certain amount of cars in the station and in the street. And everybody moves their car just as the other guy comes in. And it's really something to watch. Yet part of the deal is you got to pull the fire trucks like out of the garage so you can move the cars in behind them, right? So this morning, Andrew and I are walking down the sidewalk. All of a sudden, this guy comes flying out with the big ladder truck, parks right in front of us, all the way across half the street, doesn't even look at us. I'm thinking, wow, happy morning to you, too. We walk all the way out in the street and around. The guy never even looked at us. Like, I hope he could have whacked us, but... He got his car changed, he got his car in there, so he had that going for him. Just saying,
So they're playing car parking Tetris, is what you're
saying?
Without
a doubt. Because, they, even though the revenue for the city is giving everybody tickets, nobody from the city feels they should ever have to, that wherever they have to park should be free. You know, it's an amazing mentality, the whole mess. But anyway, Carl and I were into it yesterday a little bit about all these Supreme Court decisions and... Kevin was texting in, and I sure wanted your take on a lot of this, Lou. Plus, we got to talk about, what's going on in the Red Sea and stuff, and how much that's costing people to have tankers going around the bottom of Africa. And now they don't have enough, there's a shortage of ships because they're at sea a lot more, and all this other kind of crap. But hey,
I'm happy to dispense free legal advice. What was the question?
No, I just was the Supreme Court stuff. I mean, a lot of people are pounding on their chest that they're really good. Decisions, and a lot of people are, wailing and gnashing their teeth at the horrible decisions, and I actually like most of them, but I just, I'm getting a very, I don't know what the, you guys know the words better than me, I'm getting a very nasty view of the world that nobody pays any attention to any of this stuff, that it's not going to make any difference anywhere, and I know Kevin was texting in that, I'm in an industry where this crap has been happening for 40 years.
Which?
I mean, the idea that I'm talking about the Chevron decision.
Okay.
And I'm saying now, I should know this, but because I talk to guys like Lou all the time, but the talk about firing blanks.
I've actually argued a Chevron deference case at the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals.
I guess where I'm coming from, Lou, is that to me... The people I hang around with and the people at the industry that I know, they've never caught a break anywhere in the justice system. And it's not like, I don't know what the Supreme Court...
Perhaps this reflects more on the people you hang around
that
with.
That could very well be.
The justice system.
That could very well be. But what I'm saying
really
is...
It reflects on the people who hang around with Tom.
That's okay. Right.
That's right.
But I guess what I'm saying is, I don't know what the Supreme Court's... What they're there for. I mean, to me, if I'm going to come out with that ruling... and I'm gonna strike down something that's been there for 40 years. Well, for 40 years, every 25-year-old bureaucrat in the world has been thinking up stuff to do to people. And I understand why they changed it. I agree with them wholeheartedly. But don't you think you need to say, okay, every one of these rules that's come up in the last 40 years, you might as well burn them. They're no good. But well, it's not going to make any difference to anybody, I guess what I'm saying.
They could make it. It's not the rules, it's the interpretation, and they could make it retroactive. They, as a matter of legal practice, courts in the United States rarely make their decisions retroactive because it would be chaos. They look at this and go, people have a right, and this is, it makes perfect sense when you think about it. People have a right to rely on the law as it is. They conform their behavior to the law as it exists, and to suddenly tell them, okay, everything that's happened up to this point over the last 40 years is now null and void would undermine that kind of confidence. It would be chaotic because the courts would find themselves with thousands of lawsuits now being brought on this basis, because there's plenty of lawyers out there. There are plenty of lawyers out there who would be willing to jump on this. And so they don't make the ruling retroactive. What they do is they change the standard, and on a case-by-case basis going forward, as these rules that were adopted under the old Chevron deference standard come up, then they'll be challenged. As I said, I argued a Chevron deference case, and I won. I mean, the FDA was taking the position that their pronouncement on the efficacy and licensing of a vaccine was sacrosanct and could not be questioned by the court under Chevron, and we got the decision reversed. So, you know, the Chevron deference standard has been problematic in a number of cases, but the truth is that if you could go into federal court and basically show that the agency had not followed its own rules or was not adequately considering certain alternatives, the Chevron deference presumption disappeared, much like the presidential immunity issues are going to be challenged. So I'm happy to see it removed, because the assumptions that were in place when Chevron was decided with respect to federal agencies and how they sit as some kind of non-political, impartial pool of expertise is gone. And I don't, that if it ever existed, but it doesn't exist now for sure. And so you have a Supreme Court that said, okay, well, the rules that were in place or the assumptions we had in place 40 years ago don't exist anymore, so it's time to dump this standard.
I'm never going to argue with you on legal cases, as you know. I just come from a different... The reason I'm so hot about this is I had to drive home yesterday during the day and get my water heater fixed, of all things. Anyway, so, of course, they come on News Radio 78 with some new law that came out and said that because they're worried about people working in too hot of environments. All right. Now, you can imagine people...
Is this in Illinois?
It's come out. It came out of the Biden administration.
It's a
federal thing that now every business is going to have procedures in place for when things are too hot and people trained to deal with people that are overheating and some massive amount of crap that some firm now probably already has some common sense worried about people being too hot. Now, the person who sent that out yesterday, they didn't care about this the Supreme Court case. Right? There's no congressional mandate on taking care of people in hot factories, I don't think.
I don't think that's what the decision said, though. I don't think the decision said that there are going to be no more agency regulations. What it said is that the regulations have to follow the law. So, for instance, when the Obama administration used the Clean Air Act to regulate carbon emissions, they wouldn't be able to do that now And the reason they can't is the Clean Air Act was very specific about what kinds of emissions could be regulated. And, you know, it, and so, you know, in that case, you can't go add to it. You can't go add to the mandate that you've been given. You have to go back to Congress and say, let's amend this. It's the same thing, the same logic that gets applied to stuff like student loans is a good example. Well, we had a decision against us. We found a workaround. We're going to use some other law. It's the same thing as using aspects of Sarbanes-Oxley to go after people on the on January 6th. You know, it's a real reach. What they're doing is they're bending the existing laws to try and create new laws, and that's what's been stopped. The deference was always that the agencies, you know, whatever agency it was, had a total right to do this, and they don't.
Well, I agree. I'm saying I agree with it. I just wonder if we're so far down the road.
The clearest example, I think, is on the CAFE standards for cars. So we've gone from an authorization by Congress for the EPA to set emission standards for vehicles to in some cases, rulings that effectively mandate that everybody's going to be driving an electric vehicle by 2035. Well, that's a huge jump, but the agency would come in under Chevron and say, hey, this is rationally related to our role. You have to defer to our expertise. Now that's not the case.
Well, okay, it's not the case going forward, but these guys are embedded like a tick on a dog. I mean, just how goofy I am about this stuff. I'm sure you guys have read in your whole lifetime all kinds of insider trading cases, right? Yet, you know, I'm pretty up on this stuff. There's never once been a congressional bill that defined an insider trading. And yet the SEC wanders back and forth and defines it for anybody they don't like.
But it's the same thing with the Department of Labor stuff, Tom. I mean, the rules under the Fair Labor Standards Act and what constitutes an exempt versus a non-exempt employee change with administration to administration. It's the same thing with the National Labor Relations Board. Federal labor law gets yanked from one side of the political spectrum to the other in radical ways, depending on who's appointing the members of the board every 4 years, and they fall back on deference. Now the NLRB is a little different because there's actually a provision in the National Labor Relations Act that says this board is going to be put together and given special deference because it will be created to have special insight into the issues in the modern workplace. So there's actually a statute that says that. In most cases, there's not, and the result is these kind of whipsaw effects. I mean, you know what the facts of the actual case were, right? That ended Chevron deference.
Actually, I did read it, but I've been read so much stuff since then. Enlighten me. Enlighten everybody.
Okay, it's the fishing boat.
Yeah, the guy. We got to have somebody on his boat to watch him cut the fish up or something.
Have to hire an inspector to ride on your fishing boat to make sure that the catch is being monitored properly, and that was the rule that was put in place. And I mean, it was crazy. Again, if you want an example of the out of touch federal bureaucracy or the deep state, whatever you want to call it, here it is. Well, I think the CAFE standards are another example of the out of touch federal bureaucracy. But you know, some guy in Washington D.C. or some woman in Washington D.C. sitting at her desk decides it would be really a good idea because we've got to monitor this stuff and make sure people are actually complying with the law, because the most important thing from a bureaucracy perspective is control. So we'll pass the law, but you know, we want to make sure people enforce it, or it's being enforced properly. So we're going to mandate that you hire a private monitor, fish monitor, who has to ride on your boat, and you have to pay him. And nobody sat back and said, wait a minute, isn't this going to cost a hell of a lot of money? What's the profit margin for these guys anyway? Can they afford to do this?
Oh, wait, don't ask any of those kinds of questions, Lou. You know that.
Well, yeah, but
Tom,
that's...
It would be like saying you have to hire the FINRA auditors who come in and pay them.
They're pretty close. Exactly. They're pretty close.
I know. They're getting in that direction. I mean, one of the interesting aspects that we saw under Obama, and I'm amazed I haven't seen more of a push of this under Obama Light, which is what we should be calling Mr. Biden. Well, I know what we should be calling Mr. Biden administration, something even more derogatory now. But one of the interesting pushes that we saw in the employment area was a self-reporting requirement. If you were going to apply, and this exists for federal contractors now, but this was going to go nationwide into the private sector. Every time you filed your EEO-1 report, you had to also file a report of every claim of sexual harassment, every investigation of sexual harassment, every internal report of discrimination. All of that had to be included in the EEO-1 report. And finally, somebody, almost immediately, somebody said, wait a minute, don't we have a Fourth Amendment problem here? You're demanding that people, or a Fifth Amendment problem, Fourth Amendment, unreasonable search, Fifth Amendment, because you're requiring people to incriminate themselves. And somebody finally woke up and said, oh, yeah, I guess that's right.
Well, you don't want to tell me.
Nobody at the top thinks of this.
Well, you don't want to tell me in Illinois now. Didn't it come into play last year that if you're a big enough company, you have to send your payroll in and say whether people are black women, males, and somebody...
Oh, you've had to do that for a while.
So if somebody goes over...
Federal contractors have had to do that since 1974?
Yeah, but Lou, I guess what I'm trying to do in my stumbling way here, I'm trying to ask actually a constitutional question in the sense that, I mean, the Congress is supposed to make the laws, right? This is a simpleton version, which they lately don't seem like they want to do very well. The federal or the executive branch is supposed to enforce the laws, which they do very selectively these days, and the Supreme Court is supposed to interpret the law. And I guess my question is simple. The one about the administrative law judges, that was one of the rulings, right?
The SEC's administrative court system, yeah.
All right, so the ruling is pretty clear, right, that if it turns out that it's fines and so forth, people can't be forced into one of these kangaroo courts, for lack of a better term.
Yet who's, that's exactly right. It is a kangaroo
court. Well, but whose job is it today? I'm going to say that the head of the Streets and Sands kangaroo court on what you put in your garbage thing where they fine people, I'm going to say that guy is in no danger of getting fired. That's my bitch about this whole thing, to be put in a nutshell. And who, the parking tickets, that's a kangaroo court. Here, there no longer is a parking place you can go for tickets. You got to go to... None of these people are going to get fired, so what's the point? I guess that's my question.
So is your question that the administrative process that was put in place with these administrative law judges and all the associated personnel costs, that's still going to exist?
Without a doubt.
I don't think it's going to exist in the form it exists now.
I guess from an attorney standpoint, and from Kevin with his usual common sense, which he has, is going to say, I got news for you. If I walk into the municipal, the sanitary, whatever it is, court today and say, you guys have no legitimacy anymore, I'm getting nowhere with that one.
Well, again, it'll take legal challenges. I mean, it'll take somebody who says, I'm not paying it and I'm not going through the process, and they say, well, we'll fine you. I said, fine. Fine me.
That brings me to my next point, though, is that the average citizen has no chance of working this through up to the Supreme Court. I mean, how am I going to hire?
To go to the Supreme Court anymore.
That's the point.
Although you may
have to work your way up a little bit. Tom, let me tell you how I think this will work. To the extent that these agencies, once they're challenged, and the way the challenge would go is you would come in and they would say, well, you got to pay the fine. And you say, no, I'm not going to pay the fine. And they go, well, at some point you're going to get into what? You're going to get into the formal court system because streets and sanitation doesn't have its own police force. And the court system, you stand up and say it's a 14th Amendment, you know, due process violation or a Sixth Amendment right to jury trial violation, and I want a federal injunction, and it'll I'm almost certainly issued. But look, this is how this is going to work. The SEC or whoever the enforcement agency is going to come to you and say, you got to pay a fine, their threat used to be you got to pay a fine, otherwise you go into our kangaroo court system where I guarantee you you're going to pay a fine. Now it's going to be you're going to pay a fine, and the response will be, I don't like it, I'm going to take a jury trial, and the SEC goes, well, okay, you can pay a lesser fine, and at some point they'll reach a compromise. But now, the key now, and the point of that decision from my perspective, is that the common citizen, to the extent they get sued by the SEC, now has leverage that they didn't have before to deal with SEC overreach or enforcement proceedings. And that is, okay, great. You want me to pay a fine of $1 million? I think that's unreasonable. I don't think I did anything. We're going to drag this in front of a jury, and let the jury make the decision. And the SEC will go, huh? I'm not sure I want to try this complicated. I don't know. I'm sure I want to put a jury full of, Lou Michaels, who's an idiot. I don't want to have to explain to him, a jury box full of those guys, how this whole process works. I'm going to lose. So they'll come back with a lower offer.
Well, I know you're right. I just, in practice, we have both guys. I'm assuming one of these two guys is going to be president. They're the two biggest ignore.
I wouldn't make that assumption right now, based on the reports I'm reading this morning.
Whoever gets in there is going to be a big ignorer, or whatever the Supreme Court says. They've had a history of it. These two guys have anyway.
Who does?
Here's me.
I mean,
Donald Trump doesn't have a history. Joe Biden does, all over and over again. He brags about it. What Supreme Court case did Donald Trump ignore?
Trump lost to the Supreme Court several times and just followed the order.
Yeah.
Okay.
He did.
He does. He doesn't seem to be bound by anything before him. He thinks both of these guys are out there when it comes to paying attention to the law.
I would say that. But the Trump, at least in practice, see, this is the problem. And it's the same problem a number of my Democrat friends have. Whatever vision they have of Donald Trump is not consistent with the reality of actually, we don't have to guess what this guy's going to be like as a president. We had 4 years of it. The reality of a Trump administration. And the reality is they got reversed on a couple of times by the Supreme Court, and they said, "Okay, fine, we'll do it your way," as opposed to the Biden people, who not only ignore the Supreme Court, they brag about it.
Yeah, it's a little bizarre. I guess I don't understand why this is even why we're even arguing about this stuff. Kevin and I talk a lot about the student loan thing. To me, the student loan thing is such a screwed up system. It needs to be fixed. Why doesn't Congress just fix it? It is their job. Isn't that the snake in the room? Is it they're not going to pick up the ball and fix it?
I would also mention that why doesn't Congress fix it? If the president wants to do it by executive order, he first of all, he can't, because he has to follow the law, but he's trying to do it anyway. But aside from that, why doesn't the president have his staff pull together a bill to be presented to Congress? He didn't even bother.
No.
He didn't even bother. So, you can't complain that Congress hasn't fixed it if you haven't put forth a bill. And it's the same thing. Part of it is it's the Democrats' bill. So, they have to admit to screwing it up. Well, okay, you can go back to 2012 or whenever it was and blame the Biden administration. That's always fun to do. Any kind of pinning this on St. Barack might be a problem. So what are they going to do? But to actually just go do it unilaterally without even bothering to try and negotiate a deal, to suggest a deal, to suggest legislation, is, to me, is unconscionable.
Well, I mean, now you're having the executive branch doing the other guy. I mean, these guys.
The branch does that all the time. Okay. They prepare and present legislation. They do that all the time.
The reason why, even though I'm not going to be a Scalia, that we elect representatives every 2 years is they're supposed to have their thumb on the pulse of the people, right? You can't tell me that these guys, in their 2 year stretch there, don't hear of, you know, grandma somebody and somebody who signed some loan for somebody who's now dead and she's in a nursing home and they're tracking her down. I mean, they all know there's got to be a problem in this system, right? It's not, I mean, we're not the only three that know it. Duh. I mean, right? I wish we were. I mean, what do they do? What do they do? Say, screw grandma, we don't care? I mean, we're never going to fix it. It's a, you know, I'd rather go out and campaign. I mean, it's not like it's not a problem that everybody knows is there. I mean, I think it should be a problem, people that are paying 7% interest on some of these loans and the government's giving the other guys stuff at 0.5%. I mean, they can't be that dumb or that naive.
And thus, Kevin, we hear the case for Donald Trump coming right out of the mouth of our host.
As I've said in 100 times.
Your populist arguments, and I'm not criticizing, I'm just saying these are the populist arguments that Trump has and his people capitalize on.
As I've mentioned to you 100 times, Lou, and yep. That nobody wished more for a president to come from the outside that had some balls, basically, and shake up Washington than me. Anybody but this guy. I can't. I just can't. I mean, he's like Hillary to me. I can't vote for her because she cheated on her stuff. And I've talked to so many people where he stiffed them on bills and used the courts to not pay people. He's just an awful guy, and I don't want him there. I mean, but does 90% of what is he represents? Am I for? Yeah. Somebody from the outside, somebody could shit, but he's incompetent. He was there for 4 years. He didn't do anything. But
oh no, he did some stuff. And honestly, I'm at the stage now, and I haven't decided how I'm going to vote yet. But I'm at the stage now where all I really want to do is prevent further erosion of our civil liberties and our basic sort of constitutional structure, and I voting for, you know, a guy I'm going to now refer to as the turnip, voting for the turnip or his likely successor is not going to do that. It's going to promote it. So that's the position I'm in right now. I got to do it. I'm getting into an argument with a bunch of my friends on Facebook, and all I was trying to do, they were talking about, well, you know, it's a character issue, da da da. And I said, Mr. Biden's character is horrific. Let me remind you.
Having a character fight between these two guys is like two alley dogs.
That's right. But and yet that is the distinguishing. If you look at the comments that are coming up on Facebook, if you look at the debate that's taking place in the public fora. This is what people are saying. You know, the supporters now are trying to come out and say, well, you know, Trump's a liar and Biden isn't. And I'm, you know, maybe on the theory that you have to know what you're talking about to intend to lie, maybe that's the way that works. But this is how the differentiation is.
There's a good Federalist article about the 20 biggest lies Biden told during the debate.
I know.
And so everybody wants to document the dozens of lies that Trump told. Okay, but ignore the ones from Biden. I hate to have to defend the man because I don't like him any more than Tom does. But I am a fan of the truth, I think it needs to be told, and that's, you know, to me.
That's a great way of putting it. That's a great way of putting it, Kevin.
Well, what about our
like
buddy?
I'm going to use that.
Our psychologist friend, Dr. Blade, said that he's never seen anybody quite like Trump. He's a total narcissist, which we all know. I mean, you know, and he says if you gave the man a lie detector
every president,
test.
Every president is.
Oh, I get it, but I'm saying
you don't run for that job unless you're.
I get it, but he thinks if you gave him a lie detector test, it would just be even. The guy has no idea. He says, whatever flows, what did the guy say on what was the TV show? It's not a lie if I believe it when I told it, or something.
Yeah, Seinfeld thing.
Before
you get away from it.
I'm voting for Lou Michaels.
I always wonder how different the Trump administration might have been. I don't know if it would have been or not for sure, because this is just hypothesis. But if he hadn't spent the first 3 years fighting this whole Russia investigation that was made up out of whole cloth.
Amen. Yeah, I call that a soft coup attempt. He had a soft coup attempt run against him on that. He had a soft coup attempt run against him on Ukraine, which we now know, based on the documentation, that phone call was 100% justified. I agree with Kevin. I wonder what kind of administration you would be looking at. And I pointed out to somebody again. I said, fine. You don't like his character, you think, but let me just give you a couple of thoughts. The strength of character that it takes to withstand what effectively were two coup attempts, and to withstand multiple lawsuits that are based on, if you'll pardon the expression, trumped up charges that the courts are now disposing of. What was effectively an ex post facto civil trial, where the state changes the statute of limitations specifically to get you, the strength of character to withstand all that is something, and it's.
Again, by the way, you know what, Lou? That's not. I'll take a second here. I actually get a little of this. You know this better than me. I actually did expert witness on a arbitration one time where FINRA brought a case against somebody that had already been settled years ago, right? It was a settlement. And the SEC had some, I don't know if it was a rule or a court decision or something, NASDAQ had a court decision that their statute of limitations was 7 years. And when they kicked all the regulatory stuff over to FINRA, FINRA said that doesn't apply to us and got away with it.
It's
stunning, isn't it?
It is stunning, but I mean, again, when I talk about erosion of our civil liberties, part of that erosion is what's happening to Donald Trump.
Without a doubt.
And I mean, to watch and the people who were his ostensible supporters and the opponents of this administration, and I mean, I go on and on. Anyway, my point is, as Kevin said, and I love that line. I'm not a fan of Donald Trump, but I'm just a fan of the truth. That is a great line. I don't like him either, as I've said many times. He reminds me of my absolute worst clients. I would hate to be his lawyer, but
you'd be in jail, half a mar.
Yeah. Are we in a situation where I've got 50 people lined up in front of me and I get to pick which one I think would be the best president? No, I've got two.
Can either one of you gentlemen, and I use that term religiously, ever think of a time in your lifetime where, well, for whatever reason, the people running for president are edgy or whatever? I'm just not going. It may be one or both won't make it. Can you ever think of a time in your lifetime where you can't name at least three senators from either side of the aisle where you'd say, there's a decent, intelligent guy that could do this job if we needed him? I can't think of one on either side. Can you?
Oh, out of the Senate?
Yeah. There's probably some young guy somewhere that I don't know about, but there's no Dan Inouye. There's no, anybody with, war experience.
The woman from Iowa, Ernst.
Johnny Ernst.
Who was the dude from Tennessee? The guy was the actor, too. I thought that guy was really bright, too, the Republican guy. What the hell is his name?
Oh, yeah. Clarence Thompson. Right, yeah, Thompson, right.
Did he die? I think he did, didn't he?
He did, yes. Yeah, I mean, how about the guy who's the governor of Virginia?
The Senate. I think there's a few governors out there.
Okay. Well, in the Senate, maybe Ernst.
Yeah, we'll probably there's a decent chance we'll get a full load of J.D. Vance, and I don't know a ton about him, but he is one of the shortlist people for VP.
Yeah, he's very much an opportunist, but I mean, again, our system doesn't breed for anything but opportunists. I would look at somebody like Joni Ernst, or again, the problem, Tom, is that when you start looking for people, you're looking for somebody with name recognition, which means they have to have hung it out there in some kind of, you know, clickbait way to get the attention, and that, you know, that automatically causes you to think, yeah, I'm not sure I want this person, you know, around the levers of power.
Yeah, but I'm saying it's...
I generally had a lot of respect for Mike Lee.
Yes, yeah, Lee would be... Lee, yeah, I did too. He's,
well, it seemed like in the World War II generation, we had some backup. There were people that had done a bunch, done a bunch of stuff, led people, you know, had education, had some kind of history to them that you could say, God, these guys were in all these different situations, and they seemed to be able to do a good job no matter where they were. Maybe it's just me. I don't follow them enough. It could just be me.
But those people don't go into politics, Tom.
Well, you think that's one of our biggest issues? I think it probably is. Huh?
Yes, we've developed a ruling political caste that you know, says from the time they were 10 years old, all I want to be is a United States congressman. And that's a huge issue in my opinion.
Well, in Chicago, I know.
I did send you guys a clip last night. It was really the whole Sage Steele podcast, 1 hour sit down.
I saw it.
Yeah, and that was with Wesley Hunt and Byron Donalds. And I think you walk away from watching. It's worth watching the whole thing, but it's an hour of your time, or listening to the whole thing. But you know, the reason I sent you the cut was because of the story about negotiating with the Taliban. We can talk about that if you want. It's kind of fun, but especially Wesley Hunt. I think you listen to that guy talk a lot, and there's somebody in Congress where you look and go, "Oh my God, that guy's a right. He's got to rise up the ranks." Now maybe he'll get totally corrupted by the time he does, but at this point, very impressive man.
I like her a lot. I think she's a terrific interviewer.
I agree.
That was a great interview. I enjoyed that a lot. Tom, were there any other legal issues you wanted to?
Well, I guess one of the. You brought up an interesting point, because I've known people here in Chicago, and Kevin knows them too. I don't know if he knows exactly who they are, but he knows them. All they ever wanted to be was manipulators behind the scenes, and never wanted to run for anything. Just said, the hell with that. I just want to be enough money into somebody who's there where I can get my stuff done. And I wonder if... I would call it a shadow government, call it whatever you want. Is that what's going on here? I mean, Trump actually, you know, I'll say one thing for him. He'll be more in charge than Biden is.
Well, I would say that. We know now. Well, not know now. I've always known this. I've known this from the 2019 when he started running, when his family told him that he shouldn't run because he was showing signs of dementia, because he had dementia. I've always assumed that there was a cabal behind the curtain that was pulling the strings on Biden. You know, every now and then you'd get some, you know, Joe Bidenism out there, but I mean, from day one, I've assumed that he was so infirm and mentally bereft that there was a bunch of people behind there running the show. And for, you know, do you know who he's taking advice from now?
Hunter.
You gotta be kidding me.
I wish I was.
Hunter is now in the staff meetings.
Well, you could make a real strong case that Bush 2 was a total front. You could probably make the case.
Based on what?
Just how he was selected and how he was put in there.
how he was selected.
There's an interesting. I don't think it ever got published, Lou and Kevin. Remember the guy who used to do the Making of the President, 1960, 64, 68?
Theodore White.
Yeah, well, they. I don't think they ever published the one from the Bush first term. But
now we're talking about Bush 1 or Bush 2?
Bush 2.
Okay.
And the people, but it was being written, and it actually, I still have it at home somewhere. In the U.S. News and World, it had to be like a 30-page thing they put in there about the him and the Gore election. And evidently the people didn't, you know, the Republicans didn't like Clinton at all, which they didn't, obviously, and they had to find a way to get him out of there. So I think it was the guy who was the Secretary of Treasury and Secretary of State. He just died at like 107. What the hell's his name? You know what I'm talking about? Schultz?
Schultz
convenes a meeting of all the top Republicans down in Texas and said, who the hell are we going to run that can beat Clinton? And they ended up picking Bush. And they said, okay, if we can scrub the first 40 years of his life and the drugs and the stuff, because he's clean now.
No, Bush didn't run against Clinton, though. He didn't run against
Clinton. I understand
Clinton.
It. They hated Clinton.
No, they were looking at Gore as Clinton.
Yeah, they were looking at Gore as Clinton.
All right.
And so they got together and they raised like $30 million before the guy even started out, which was huge money in those days.
So how is this different than Barack Obama?
No, I'm saying he was my next guy. I think he was a front for somebody too. I mean, how do we get around this, or do we ever?
Well,
I actually suspect that Biden's first run was his practice run, and he caught fire. Or excuse me, not by Obama.
Could be. Yeah,
I think they were going to defer to Hillary, but they were building up a star there, and then he kind of caught fire and unexpectedly.
Well, but the thing
to quote the turnip, he's clean, he's articulate.
Yeah, without a doubt. I mean,
that's what the
well,
turnip
I mean,
said.
Bush. They basically, the guy owned a baseball team. He's very likable. If you sit down and have a beer with the guy, you'd have a good time. I don't know if he drinks anymore. But there's nothing wrong with the dude personally. His wife's terrific. I mean, he comes from a solid family. So he ends up losing to McCain in Iowa. And then the people put the money up, go, what the bleep? Or was it New Hampshire someplace? And they put up, we just put this money up, and this guy's losing to this guy McCain, who we can't stand because we can't control him. So they ended up launching all this bad stuff. The internet had just come out about how McCain's wife was cheating on him when he was in the, you know, prisoner of war, and how the reason why he got out is because he gave secrets. He ends up getting clobbered in Carolina by Bush because of all the bad stuff that other people, Bush didn't do it, spread around about him. And that's the reason why McCain wouldn't even shake his hand at the convention, because those guys launched all that dirty stuff.
I'm sorry. I'm gonna revert back to, you know, Chicago politics ain't beanbag.
Oh, it's bare knuckle. There's no question.
I mean, this is so. I assume when I see people surface, and get this kind of prominence, I assume there is a well-financed political machine behind them somewhere. And again, the scary and terrifying thing about Donald Trump in 2016 and in 2020 is that he was not like that.
Right.
Which is what I've always liked about him,
by the way.
Agreed. And he's tapped into that resentment and frustration with government and what government is supposed to do, and he's tapped into all of that. And that's why, you know, that's why 30-40% of the Republican base is not going to vote for anybody else. And that's why you've got this bunch of idiotic never Trumpers in the Republican side, the traditionalists, who are just tearing their hair out.
Well, you ought to be able to find. We ought to be able to find somebody.
They'll never get a candidate. They will never get a candidate past the Trumpians. Because they have a lock on 30-40% of the Republican electorate that says government is not helping us. We want somebody who's going to, you know, take our side.
I, you know, who said that? Probably the most eloquently of anybody was Michael Moore, of all people.
Yeah. Yep.
I mean, people are tired. I don't think that most of the people in government have any idea of how most people despise it. And yet, we were talking about yesterday with Carl. Carl actually supported some people down for representative in Florida. The craziest, in my opinion, one of the most crazy polls ever, showing how people are messed up, all of us, is what everybody is convinced that their representative is terrific and that Congress is horrible. You know, how does that work?
And the ultimate poll being the elections themselves, and yeah, everybody hates Congress but vote for the same people.
And 20% of the people show up. How Karen Reeves, who was on the show a couple of times, one of the nicest people I've ever met and very bright, had a whole history of accomplishment. How she managed to lose to Jesse Jackson Jr. with 25% of the people voting. I mean, for God's sake, I guess you could say we get what we deserve or whatever. And he got $1.5 million from Lloyd, the guy from Bitcoin. He never gave it back. I mean, a lot of the other people did. They gave it to charity. He never did.
Is he out of jail yet?
No, that's the brother.
Oh, okay.
No, Bankman-Fried, is he out of jail?
Oh, no, I don't think so. Well, I think he's in for a while.
Yeah, okay. No,
I thought you meant, Jesse Jackson.
Didn't Jesse Jackson Jr. go to jail?
Yeah, this is the brother.
Yeah, okay.
Did he go to jail for something he did when he was in Congress? I think he did, didn't he? Or was it not in Congress? It was in the state? I'm not sure about that. I shouldn't say anything. It was something to do with government. He was in some elected office, wasn't he? Oh, I don't know that.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't remember.
So, I mean,
there's so many.
By the way, I agree with you guys. I really think the Supreme Court, by and large, did a hell of a lot of good work here. I just wonder going forward.
They dropped the ball yesterday, and they dropped the ball.
Which was yesterday?
On the social media.
Yeah, I didn't understand it that way. Why don't you take a minute, Lou? I didn't understand it that much. What happened there?
On the social media?
Yeah.
Censoring?
Oh, yeah.
I think, if you want my honest assessment, I think that John Roberts was looking around saying, I can't have all these decisions going in one direction. We need to throw a bone to the progressives, and so, or the Democrats, depending on how you want to look at it. And so they punted that case. I don't think you could find a clearer example of government suppression of free expression than what you saw in those government agencies set up to monitor Twitter, Facebook, and a number of other places. And the lower courts had no trouble finding problems. The Supreme Court did not address the merits of the case. What they said was, hey, we don't, the attorneys general who brought these cases on behalf of their citizens, whose speech was being suppressed, they ignored the individual plaintiffs, Jay Bhattacharya and somebody else out of Stanford who had been damaged, had their Twitter accounts shut off, their Facebook accounts frozen, at the request of government, okay, at the request of the government, they ignored the individual plaintiffs. They said that the state's attorney generals who brought these cases did not have standing. In other words, they were not subject to a tangible injury. Now, I've only dealt with constitutional law in the periphery, but one of the absolute rules in constitutional litigation, civil litigation, is that if you allege a constitutional violation, injury is presumed. You don't have to show.
You know, I've read that too, Lou, somewhere, and I'm not a lawyer. I've read that too.
Yeah. Yeah, injury is presumed. You do not have to show irreparable harm. And the idea that you know, these guys didn't have standing because they couldn't point to something specific, the attorneys general couldn't, the Bhattacharya could easily do that. The court just kind of waved its hand at this. The merits...
Maybe they were tired. Maybe they were tired.
The case goes forward. I mean, there's litigation on this issue, and it's going to be litigation on this issue in the lower courts. But... I thought that was just stupid.
Does that mean they might get it again?
Yes.
All right. Well, thank you, guys. We got to head off here to Russell. Kevin, if you are hanging at 7:30, Russell's got a dash at 7:30. We can talk a little sports and stuff. If you got to go, you got to go.
I can jump back on at 7:30. Yeah. I think. Let me take care of that.
Lou, thank you for coming on. We won't see you for a couple of weeks, right?
Right, sir. I'll be back. The 25th?
All right, bud. Well, I'll be loaded with questions for you. You can only imagine. 2 weeks of no Lou. I have how many questions a week do I have for you? For God's sake, I never get to the bottom. Right. Take care of yourself. SP Futures down 75 cents. NASDAQ Futures down 7. Be right back, Professor Russell.
Hello, this is Tom Howell, the Chief. I think most of you know that I'm also the Chief Investment Officer at PTI Securities and Futures. There we invest for and help a wide variety of clients. And you know what? No two are the same. Some have legacy stocks, some concentration issues, some maybe embedded tax issues. The others might need or want some portfolio protection. There could be estate issues or maybe new family members. The point is that we are all unique and the portfolios should match. However, the last several years have seen a relatively one-way market. It seemed that all we needed was to be all in. No protection, no fixed income, just be all in, no matter who you are, what your risk profile or age. Most management firms love that. Take this and like it, no matter who you are. Be careful with that. You are not everybody. I think most see the market view going forward as maybe different than the one looking back, so your portfolio should reflect that. Maybe just as simple as your life station has changed. Towards that end, we are accepting some new clients needing a more personal approach and are interested in negotiating the future and not with a portfolio designed for the past. Find me at 312-663-4310. That's 312-663-4310.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Something happening here. What it is. Low and one base stocks and jacks. I'm tomorrow. Andrew on the board. SP Futures unchanged. NASDAQ Futures are unchanged as well. They were just down, but they're kind of all over the place. But whenever the NASDAQ's down in the morning, you sort of have to assume it's going to go back up. But we'll see how that works. Do we have the professor?
We do have the professor. And since you mentioned the NASDAQ, I will mention an interesting statistic about the NASDAQ 100.
Okay.
You ready? Because we're grumpy old men and we never say anything positive.
Right.
If the NASDAQ 100 is up about 17% or so year to date, since the year 2000, we have not had a negative second half if the NASDAQ is up 10% or more for the first half. Yeah, my wife's in the car. She just said, really? Yes. Yeah, I wrote a whole article on it yesterday, honey. Don't you read what I write?
Oh, God.
So.
Oh, God.
Driving me to the doctor because I can't see right now.
You're going to be 100%, I assume.
At some point, yes. This is another residual from my face plant last year on the electric scooter.
Wow!
Stay away from electric scooters.
Did they have to put a? Did you get a contact lens in there so you don't have to wear glasses?
That's the first time I've had a cataract done. I'm kind of young for it, but I think I probably was the youngest person in the waiting room, except for people who brought their kids along to drive them home yesterday. But when I hit the pothole on the electric scooter going full steam and hit the corner of my head, it knocked my cataract loose.
Ah, good.
So, and yeah, I've been seeing fuzzy for like a year, and hopefully this is the I'm on the road to recovery. Woohoo!
Well, so good for you. It's funny how everybody's body, even though we all age, mm-hmm. we all kind of age differently. It's sort of weird.
Yeah.
It's sort of weird. I mean, obviously I'm not certainly not what I was when I was 45 or even after that. But I just had my eyes checked. The lady goes, there's not one speck of age related problems you have. She goes, that's almost incredible at your age. Yet other stuff's falling apart. I mean, you just never know. I mean, some people have the world's they can still run a marathon when they're 85, and yet everything else is falling apart. I mean, it's weird, yeah. Isn't it? We don't age evenly, do we?
No, we don't. I've got four good toes on my left foot, and that's about it. The rest of me is just falling apart.
Someday there'll be a drug for this.
So hey, you guys were talking about the election thing, and I totally agree. I think Obama was even when he was running against Hillary, You know, I think everybody felt like he was running for vice president, and he was running for president 8 years down the road.
Well,
because you know, he's still, I don't know his age, but he's still a lot younger than the two guys that getting to choose between right now. I'm gonna differ with you a bit.
Okay.
One of the things that, and we're gonna have our political reporter on next week. She's willing to come on next week.
Oh, cool.
Which is, for those of you who don't know, my daughter's a journalism student in D.C. and has a couple of internships and has some interesting insights. Plus, she's a nice different generation than most of the people that are on here. So I think that it'll be a good mix around there. But one of the grumblings that I've heard is that the Bidens have always been very angry with the Obamas, because the Obamas talked Biden out of running when Hillary ran. And they felt like, you know, he probably would have been able to beat Trump, but Hillary wasn't able to beat Trump.
I'm not so sure that he's wrong there.
Obamas on that.
I'm not so sure he's wrong there.
And so I'm not sure if Barack took him aside and said, you know, man, for the good of everything. And I think, I do think there's a consensus around the world feeling right now, if you're worried about global stability, et cetera, that the best thing Joe Biden could do is, you know, is pass the baton on to somebody else. Because it's not so much how he looked last week, it's what the heck is he going to look like in 4 years?
Well, and he also has a massive problem with the vice president. Nobody wants her.
Yeah, that's kind of unfortunate as well, that there's not, and that really, you know, I say unfortunate because it's very worrisome if you know, he were to pass, if she were to end up taking over. Just I'm not sure how competent she would be. I've always felt that way about her, and you have to be very cautious when you say some things. But I do have some concerns about that. But you know, if you really want to get elected, and you're on Biden's side right now, or you're not on Biden's side right now, all you got to say is you're really voting for Kamala for president.
Oh yeah, it's a well, you know, there has been this is not a, well, certainly for me and you, it's not a race or gender issue. There has been history of this before. I mean, when Roosevelt, the people around him knew that he wasn't going to make it through his next term, they dumped Wendell Willkie like a hot rock, right? And that's how.
Yeah.
I mean, I still I was stunned when I read that piece in Freedom from Fear, where Truman was called to the White House, and they asked, and Roosevelt was in the room, and whoever was given the interview said, you know, we've decided to go a different direction as a vice president candidate. Would you like to be the vice president? And they're talking back and forth, and Truman looked over at Roosevelt and saw the condition he was in and said, this was not an interview for vice president, this was an interview for president. And, you know, Roosevelt was in real bad shape at that point. I mean, his blood pressure was what? 240 over like 140 or something.
You think he was putting in less than 6 hours a day?
I think Roosevelt was probably more of the, according to Arm & Hammer, he was the smartest man that ever walked. And Arm & Hammer knew a lot of those people.
Here's one of my big concerns with respect to who's running the country right now. I really do think that to a certain point, the cabinet are the people that are more involved in the day-to-day stuff.
Oh, sure.
And I don't know how much confidence I have in his cabinet.
Well, I mean,
and
Trump had all kinds of good guys in there, and he fired them all. So, I mean, exactly has put the best people in the best spots and let, you know. I think this is really crazy. I think the guy who upset the whole apple cart in terms of the ages that you went through, very eloquently, I might add, was Bush 1. Clinton was never supposed to win. He was a trial run for the next time. He was too young. And Bush.
Yeah, nobody really. I mean, I knew who he was because, you know, I grew up in Memphis, and everybody's like, well, what the hell does that have to do with it? Memphis, I mean, when they changed the drinking laws in Tennessee before they changed them in Arkansas. I spent a lot of time in Arkansas when I was under 21 but above 18.
There you go.
because Memphis, and you know, one of the funny things that people say sometimes is Memphis is the biggest city in Tennessee and Arkansas and Mississippi, because it borders all three. You know, well, it's in Tennessee, but it borders Arkansas and Mississippi. So, you know, we were very familiar with him. Hell, I worked with somebody who was an analyst at First Tennessee Bank, who had a picture of her meeting Clinton when he was governor.
Well, he was governor, and then he wasn't, and then he was back again, right? He did two terms,
I believe so. I think he did win, and he did lose an election at one point.
Yeah, he was in, he was out, and then he was back in. But everybody, all the big shot Democrats, and I can't remember who they even were at the time, all thought Bush was a shoe-in. So
things were going fairly well.
Yeah, and he's, you know, Bush one was a likable guy. I mean, I think he had a huge issue with the oil industry, and probably still does. Or, well, he's dead, but the, I mean, nobody wanted to run against him. So Clinton's like, mm-hmm. I'll do it. That way, I'll win in 4 years. And all of a sudden, Bush totally self-destructed, and Clinton was a lot more articulate than people gave him credit for, and he ends up winning way too young. Mm-hmm. I mean, he'd have been, I think, a terrific president if he was 4 years older and wasn't chasing every skirt in town.
I recall the day after Clinton got elected watching CNN, when CNN was a bit unbiased, and they had a commentator on CNN that said, you know, what was really interesting last night was everybody looked around at each other and said, well, now what do we do? Once Clinton got elected, it was like they weren't really, you know, they hadn't thought through exactly what, because, and part of it was they weren't 100% sure they were going to win that thing.
Well, and Bush won. He totally, he didn't want a campaign. He didn't like it. Wasn't very good at it. And Clinton was actually really good. But hey, well, I got you. I know you got a dash before a normal time. I keep, every day it goes up, this constant, a few stocks racing up as soon as anybody, you know, and yet everybody who puts money in their 401k and puts it in the, you know, the market, even without even knowing they're doing it, they're putting 50% of their money in those seven stocks. And it seems like we're locked into this. I mean, I guess I'll ask you a really stupid question. If we all just bought stocks or houses, let's say stocks, every day and nobody ever sold, would we all be rich someday? And maybe made in Congress put in a law you couldn't short sell and you couldn't buy puts, and all we could do is buy. Would we all be rich, and would it be real? I think people think that's what's going on here, and I think people think it can go to the moon, because I see valuations in some of these stocks that maybe it's the new world. It just might be an old grumpy dude, but they're way higher than 2000. The housing is way higher than it was in 2007 under any. If you compare it to incomes, it's not even close. It might be 50% higher than 2007. And yet, doesn't seem to faze anybody, except an awful lot of people I know can't afford a house, can't afford a car, and never will. So we've had this, it's almost like an amazing quiet revolution where 10% of the people have stolen all the money from the other 90, and yet nobody seems to see it or know what to do about it. It's weird.
It's funny you bring the housing thing up, and I have my housing specialist driving me to my appointment right now. But you know, I live in a suburb called Hinsdale, for those of you that are not from Chicago, which is one of the nicer suburbs. And you know, it's one of those places that when you move there for the schools. It's one of the top public high schools in Illinois. So this time of year, you have a big turnover. You have people whose kids have gone off to college, and you know, now's the time to downsize your house. There are a lot of homes for sale at very high prices in Hinsdale, and I don't think anybody's going to buy them.
That's interesting, because in Orland, if it's on the market, not the same price. In Orland, if it's on the market a day, you know, Audrey's trying to find it, getting somebody over there. There's nothing around.
I think I do think that there's at a certain level, people have just been priced out of houses.
Oh, I think they have too. I mean, have you ever seen this? Well, I'll give you an economic question, since you're the professor. Can you think of any other time in history? Because I mean, you and your guys research this stuff. You think of any other time in history where mortgage rates doubled and housing prices went up, or interest rates went from zero to five and the market ran up for 25%. I can't think of it.
Well, I don't know about the stock market part. When you had just the first two parts there, I was thinking maybe the 70s.
Well,
where interest rates went up and because we had so much inflation.
Yeah, I don't think housing prices went up.
Yeah.
I don't know. I know that it was interesting when you sold a house or bought a house back then, because I sort of was in the remodeling business. Some of the stuff you do before, a lot of times the seller would lend the down payment to the buyer. You know, that kind of stuff. I mean, all people did all kinds. I mean, you actually had, boy, remember this? And if your wife is with you, does she remember assumable mortgages?
No, I do not.
You used to be able to have a mortgage where the next person, if they qualified, could take your mortgage where their rates were going up so fast.
I do not recall. I know of that happening, but I do not recall that.
Yeah, we almost had one in one of my places, but we didn't. But yeah, if it was going up and you could catch one at like 8.5, you might even have paid 8.75 to have it assumable, because it was going up so fast. You figured if it goes to 12, I'll never be able to sell this place. So you sort of locked in the monthly for future owners, which actually makes some sense when you think about it.
Mm-hmm. It totally makes some sense.
Are you guys there?
We're here. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I'm saying, you didn't pull another spot yet. You're good to go. You're okay.
Yeah. No, I'm good.
So what do you, I'm talking to clients, potential clients all day.
Mm-hmm.
What do you tell, I've had people recently that want to open up accounts, and they're pretty much all in T-bills, okay?
Yeah.
And I'm not so sure, and they're looking for me to say, when can I get involved, when's the price right, when can we be protected, blah, blah, blah. There's those kinds of people. There's other people who have somehow matriculated into these stocks, and that's what they're in, and they just want one more day. I'll talk to you in 2 weeks, and then they go up a little bit more.
Yeah.
I'll talk to you another 2 weeks, And there's no ability whatsoever to say, I'm going to sell my NVIDIA at 130, and if it's trading 132 6 months from now, I'm not going to be pissed off. Everybody's convinced they deserve the top tick. And if they don't get, but you know, people weren't always like that. I mean, you know,
no.
I mean, leave a little something for the next guy, but I don't know how you, I actually had a client call up last week. He says, can you put together a position for me where I go long NVIDIA, Tesla, Microsoft, and Apple, and I go short the rest of the NASDAQ. And I go, really? I mean, I could do that for you, but God, do you really want to do that? I mean, I'm probably one of the few.
I would do exactly the opposite.
That's what I was thinking, but I didn't say that.
I have a stat that it's good, so I have to share it. Only 25 of the 100 NASDAQ 100 stocks are up this year.
We have, as you can probably imagine, with a brokerage firm. I mean, my brother knows more about all the rest of the people's accounts. I pretty much just know the people that I'm managing. But Dan says we have an amazing array of stocks, from people who are in dividend stocks, they're into smaller stocks, they're into some banks, they're into all kinds of stuff. He says we probably have, on a day like yesterday, which was a pretty good sizable up day, he goes, I'm going to say 80% of the stocks are people own or down. On a day that we just raced to the moon. If you take Tesla out of the NASDAQ, it probably wasn't even up, was it? Or it was up some? Tesla was up, what, $20? It's up another five today.
Tesla was the big bump yesterday.
And what is...
Most definitely.
I'm going to say, you probably know this off the top of your head, I'm going to say that, I was having this discussion last night, if you take the increase in market cap in the last month and a half in Microsoft and in Apple, just the increase in market cap, is that as much as the entire Russell?
I think it's greater.
I've got Apple up. It's up like 30-some bucks, and there's 15 billion shares outstanding. Yeah. So that's $400 billion right there, right?
Yeah. No, it's the whole market cap of the Russell 2000 is, I know it's less than a trillion.
So those four stocks actually were up more in the last month than the entire Russell.
Oh, yeah. The last week when NVIDIA was down, the amount that NVIDIA was down over the course of like set of five trading days was the equivalent of the 20th largest S&P 500 stock market cap.
Of course, everybody's wailing and gnashing their teeth how it was down. It was up that same amount the week before. Right?
Oh, I know. I know.
Yeah, I mean, oh, yeah. I'm just saying it. I mean, 100 billion here, 100 billion there. You think people are buying this stuff even realize what does $400 billion in market cap even mean? I mean, in Apple, the revenue hasn't gone up in how many years?
No, I think that we reach those numbers, and those numbers are, just over the top ridiculous.
I mean,
they become very difficult to perceive.
Well, if a lot of guys, most guys aren't big shoppers, although some people are.
Uh-huh.
They usually like the kid how their wife or girlfriend likes to shop. I think if you dropped like $1 billion on your wife or girlfriend, even she would be a little, what do I do with this? What do you want me to buy exactly with $1 billion? Yeah. I mean, most of the ladies I know aren't into buying 100-foot yachts, but where would you even go shop for one of those? I wouldn't even know. But it's
all right. They're yanking. They're getting ready to yank me in here.
Okay, bud. All right. So, take care of yourself.
Have a good holiday, and I will speak with you next
week. Andrew, why don't we go to break, and then Kevin and maybe John will be on afterward. We'll actually we'll do a regular break and give what all the markets are doing. Be right back. Stocks and Jacks.
How much confidence do you have that your investments will make you wealthy? Do you truly know the odds? Welcome to Luckbox, the control freak's guide to life, money, and probability. Luckbox shows you how to factor in the likelihood of success before you commit to an investment or any other life decision. Your brain is smarter than your gut, and that's why you owe it to yourself to read Luckbox. We've made it easy because Luckbox is free for 1 year at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Each new issue dives deep into the current investing climate, separates the signal from the noise with timely, actionable trading ideas, and equips you with savvy investing tactics you don't already know, all while exploring how to live your best life through music, spirits, food, sports, travel, fitness, and a whole lot more. Luckbox is the essential magazine for proactive investors who are hell-bent on controlling their financial futures. It's for overachievers and alpha types who don't buy into Wall Street's investment gurus. It's for mavericks who believe in life, luxury, and the pursuit of happiness. It's for you! Smart investors don't bet on possibilities, they play the probabilities. Luckbox is $7.99 on newsstands, but you can subscribe for 10 free digital issues at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Don't rely on luck. Get Luckbox at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks.
Hello, this is Tom Howell, the Chief. We've talked a lot on the show about risk and suitability, about how your portfolio should match your age, income, and risk appetite. It's been hard for investors to maintain that suitability in the last several years due to a Fed strategy that has driven interest rates to virtually zero. You may have even heard that the Fed was trying to drive conservative investors to a riskier portfolio on purpose, for whatever reason. I'm sure you are aware of investors that took some increased risk, such as longer-term fixed income securities, and are now unhappy with that choice. PTI, we've always stressed total portfolio risk awareness and tried to minimize chasing returns in a tough environment. Well, now it looks like maybe interest rates are moving more towards historical levels. Everyone needs to be aware of what that continued movement might do to your portfolio, both good and bad. We also have a stock market that seems to have stalled, at least for the short term. I think it's time for everyone to take a serious look at their goals, their risks, and their portfolios. Do they match? If not, we can help. We have a signature protected index program. We have ways to hedge against interest risk. We can make that portfolio right for you again. Go to PTISecurities.com or call us right now. The market can change very rapidly. That's PTISecurities.com.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Hello, North Bank Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tom Allen, Andrew on the board. S&P futures down 7 now. NASDAQ futures down 29. We have a very interesting morning here, actually. Not just what we're talking about, but in the markets. Not much movement in any of the stuff. Dow's only down 3 points. But a lot of all the other stuff is going kind of crazy here because currencies are moving around. DAX up 165.9%. That's probably a reflection of us yesterday. We ran up late in the day. FTSE up 42.5%. CAC around up 109, 1.4%. They're making back a lot of what they have been down with the political situation over there. We have over in Asia. These guys have been all over the black. Nikkei, however, is up a huge again, up 506, 1.3%. I think they're going to start putting some money in the system over there or what, or whatever they're doing. 40,580. That's a huge record high. Hang Seng up 209. 17,978, could not make it over 18,000. However, Shanghai is down 14 points. It's 0.5%, 2982, as it's still struggling under 3,000. So mainland China, Hang Seng, not the best, but the Nikkei is going to the moon. At least it appears that way. Yesterday, Dow was up 162, S&P up 33, NASDAQ up 149, pretty much totally erasing the loss of the day before. The loss was last Friday we were down. Or was it Monday? One of the two. Bonds down 1 basis point, 4.43. The Bund unchanged, 2.60. Japan, 1.10. So they've shot up from 0.93 to 1.1 probably in 10 trading days. Has a lot to do with their market and what they're doing with their currency for sure. Oil up 14 cents, 82.95. Brent up 17 cents, 86.41. Natural gas unchanged, 2.43. RBOB down a penny, 2.56. Gold, and here's what's in action here. Gold's up 23 bucks, 23.56. Silver up 99 cents now. It's 3.5%, 30.65. Copper up 9 cents, 4.51. So the metals are on fire here this morning. Bitcoin down 1,700, 60,141, still over 60,000. And here's probably the bugaboo. If the U.S. dollar is a little bit lower again, 107.6 against the euro, and it's 127.07 against the British pound. Japanese yen up to 161.88. All that stuff's playing into their market and everything else here. It's all connected. Andrew, what do you got for us? Trevi Weather Sports.
All right. It is 7:29 here in Chicago on July 3rd. Starting up a little bit of sports, all of our favorite teams lost in the most latest baseball games. White Sox lost against the Guardians 6-7. The Cubs lost against the Phillies 6-4. And the Diamondbacks lost to the Dodgers 5-6. Over to Chicago weather, it is currently 74 degrees right now. We're going to have a high of about 78 today, and that's going to hit... No, excuse me. We're going to have a high a little bit more around 80, 83 today. It's going to get a little bit warmer than that. Let's see. Over in Phoenix, they are currently at 94 degrees. They're in a heat warning right now, and they're going to have a high of about 105. That's going to hit around 12 p.m.
Ouch.
So a lot warmer than it is around here, but over for Chicago traffic, looks like the major expressways have kind of cleared up from some accidents earlier. All I'm looking at here is that we have some slowdowns on the inbound expressways, especially near Damien Avenue on the Stevenson. But about that, there's nothing too worrisome on there. Thankfully, no accidents.
Stevenson was closed for 4 hours. A shooting caused a four-car crash.
You know what? You're right. Yeah, I saw that earlier. Got hidden here, but now it is. Now I see it again. Yeah, that is. Let's see. Stevenson North between Ryan Expressway and Cermak is backed up to Cicero Avenue.
Yeah. A
fatal shooting investigation. All traffic being diverted to the Dan Ryan.
Yeah, you got to go south to come back.
Yep.
It's all messed up. Do we have our guys?
Yes, we do.
Gentlemen. Kevin, haven't talked to you in
ages. Charred, shaved, and fresh coffee.
Kevin, haven't talked to you in ages.
Yeah, it's been a while.
Andrew went down
to... Good morning,
to
John. How you doing, John?
John,
good morning, Kevin, Tom, Andrew.
Here's the state of the world we're in. Andrew hustles down the block to the Dunkin' Donuts, and all I had was a 100, and he has his debit card. Well, they couldn't break the 100, so he comes back, drags down, finds a 20, heads back. They can't break the 20 either. When the coffee and everything else is like $8. So it's not like they're not charging a lot. It's like, what a world, eh?
Cashless society, Tom.
That's crazy, but let's go back to this. All I had was 100.
Well, I had 105 ones, and the five ones didn't
cut. What's with that, Tom?
I had 105 ones, and the five ones didn't cut it because the coffee's $4 a throw. So there.
Okay.
So I bet I had the Benjamin in there, you know. Just saying. By the way,
such a big shooter.
Oh, yeah. What does this say about society in parts of the city when on the north side they pretty much are trying to do their best to not take cash in a lot of places, and yet on the south side virtually every place now if you use a credit card, they add 3%, they want you to use cash. Is that saying on the south side they want to find a way for their people to be able to go 3% less? Or side they don't care? What is the social... If Dr. Blade was here, what would he say about that?
It means you got a lot of businesses on the south side working on really, really thin margins. really thin gross margins, and they're trying to get they're not willing to give up. They're probably also getting charged a pretty high discount rate by their credit card servicer, and as a result, they're trying to recover some of that.
Stupid question. When you get these reward cards, and I have, well, my Discover card. I actually like my Discover card, but every quarter they give you a spot where you're 5% off, and the last quarter was 5% off on gas. Now, does every gas station automatically give those guys the 5% or what? Where else does it come from?
Not sure how that works. I would guess you certainly can't penalize the company unless the company is a willing participant in the promotion and is willing to do it to get more business in the door.
Interesting, because remember, Jen, when
it's like putting something on sale.
Yeah.
Of course, when it comes to gasoline, gasoline never goes on sale anywhere. It's kind of a fixed price everywhere you go, within a penny or two.
Well,
unless you go to Costco.
Well, when Costco used to have the American Express card, I had the Costco American Express, but I also have my American Express I've had for 100 years. And when I went to give the American Express card to people at this restaurant on the south side, they said, we're not taking the Costco card, but we'll take the other one. The Costco card is too much of a rebate. Then when they were giving you 3% back, and the regular one's only 1%, I think. It's weird.
Yeah, I'm not sure by the clearing group rules, I'm not sure they have the... obviously they did it, but I'm not sure they had the leeway to do that. I think pretty much if you're going to sign up to be a merchant that takes American Express, I think you got to take everybody's American Express card.
I would have thought so too, but the Costco one, you were getting more back, I know, and then that whole thing blew up, and now they're with Citibank. Anyway, so John, you were listening to some of our stuff earlier. Hey, Kevin, I don't know if you were listening when Janet was on the other day. I have a question for you, because it was a follow-up discussion last night. The amount of tax increases that are hitting these predominantly very poor suburbs on the south side of Chicago is something, Kevin, like I've never even seen. I mean, it's bizarre. I mean, Audrey sold a house down there for, I'm going to say, low 60s, and the taxes were $6,500. Is it... The gentleman last night, and an attorney, doesn't mean he's good or bad. Is it a desire to force, most of these people are African American, is it a desire to force them back in the city because of the amount of African American people that have left the city in the last 10 years? You think it's somebody could be that calculating? I mean,
I think they could be calculated enough, John. You can comment about this too. But if you force enough people out of their homes, especially if they're relatively low income neighborhoods. I mean, they don't have to be, blighted, horrible shape income neighborhoods, but you force enough people out of their homes, they sell it when there's a lot on the market at the same time. Real estate companies are the ones that snap them up. Now you have, you may have enough unattended property that some of it becomes blighted, some of it just becomes teardowns, and next thing you know, up goes a development that has a whole lot of mixed use on it.
I don't see that happening in Posen, do you, Jen?
No, and that's the thing that's part of this too, and the reason why it's hitting these south suburbs so hard this time around is they're reassessed, is that the lack of businesses in a place like Phoenix or Harvey, some of these old kind of Rust Belt suburbs that at one time had lots of manufacturing, lots of businesses, restaurants, small businesses, construction companies, all this stuff, that's pretty much vanished in huge swaths of the south suburbs. And that's taxed at a higher rate than residential property. And there's an article on Wire Points this week talking about this doom loop in the south suburbs and how what's happening in downtown Chicago with the lack of performing commercial properties has put a real dent in the tax revenue for the whole county. And it's really exaggerated in the south suburbs, because there's nothing, say, in Phoenix that can be taxed as commercial property, pretty much. I don't know if there's any ongoing concerns in Phoenix that I can recall. I mean, I can't picture any businesses of any kind when I think about it. So the burden falls on the, you know, residential properties. And Maria Pappas, who's the treasurer, says that some of these south suburbs now have, you know, collection rates hovering around 65%, which means that, you know, 35% of the tax bills are not being paid.
John, so if somebody, just a dumb question again from Evergreen Park, where Evergreen Plaza was, if all of a sudden you and I and Kevin go down and put some big successful shopping center, let's say in Phoenix, you know, which is, there's a lot of small suburbs down there. So now, does a suburb next door get any benefit of that, or is it just that particular little spot where it happens to be?
Well, the township gets it. You know, that's how the taxing authorities are carved out. So there's lots of properties near Phoenix in that township that would benefit from any commercial, you know, enterprise anywhere in that township to boost the tax base. So they would all share in it to some extent.
So Evergreen Plaza wasn't just Evergreen Park. It was anybody in Worth Township.
Right, right.
Okay, I did not know that.
But, I mean, at 95th Street, you know, all the, there were businesses up the wazoo, up and down the streets. So,
well, I mean, I guess my question is, with something like Lincoln Mall goes down, is it just, if Lincoln Mall happens to be in Timbuktu, is it only Timbuktu that's affected, or is there all the stuff around there? It seems like you've answered that question. It's everybody around there.
And Madison, where it was located, of course, has taken a big hit. But places like the smallest suburbs, like Dixmoor and Phoenix, and Dixmoor did have businesses. I mean, they had a shopping mall. I think Dixie Square opened in the 60s sometime, and that was like, it was a model, modeled on Evergreen Plaza, although it was very much smaller. But that's been long gone, and there's been nothing in those smaller places to support those particular towns. But the hit is to the township, really, and it's not just a problem of Phoenix and Dixmoor. It's across the board where businesses have not, you know, survived.
Should we quiz our buddy Kevin on what the Dixie Mall was used for, and what famous movie?
Well, you can quiz me all you want. I won't get it right.
That was, remember the scene where they busted up the shopping center and the Blues Brothers? That was at the Dixie Mall, because they just closed it. So they put the windows back in and put like some merchandise in there, and they actually had the big, where the cars were bashing through the windows and stuff. That was at the recently closed Dixie Square Mall.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. We used to go out there. I mean, my dad worked for a while doing real estate in the south suburbs, and he knew all this. When something's going to happen or open, he'd be there to check it out. So we all went out there. We ate at some of the restaurants, shopped at some of the stores. Thought, well, this is a good sign, but it didn't last very long.
Well, Glenwood, I mean,
that's your other aspect to this, is that it's, and I know I'm kind of stating the obvious here, but it's what other commerce happens because there's a successful business there.
Right. That's key, Kevin. And that's tipped very much in the opposite direction now in old patches of you know, the metro area. And as the larger malls like Stratford Square and some of these other places have folded, that causes a huge ripple effect in other businesses that can't sustain themselves too.
Kevin or John, what is the, I should remember this because I've seen it, what is, if we were to put together, you know, the subject I'm somewhat familiar with, if we were to decide we're going to build and rehab railroad cars in Chicago, and we found a place on the south side or wherever, you know, it's got to be obviously near a railroad track. You know, we put a place up, and we get a lot of business, and we've got 400 people making good money in this place. What's the number of other jobs that essentially spews out of that? Isn't it? Is it 1-to-1, John, or is it 1/2-to-1? I thought it was almost like 1-to-1, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think that would seem reasonable to me. Just having people go into these places as employees and, you know, hang around, go to lunch, you know, it's got all sorts of
Well, you're not going to make your own fasteners. You're not going to make all your own screws and bolts. So you're going to, there's some people probably now going to put up a place close to you to do that, or at least around.
Well, you might get that, or you might just get trucking activity, you know, where people are bringing the supplies from outside the area. But when you do, that means you need a truck stop or two. What else does it mean? Well, it means, you know, again, as John said, people, you know, it'll be restaurants. People will eat. Maybe not every day. It will be taverns for people leaving after work. And then, you know, you get people, if you have 400 employees, all of a sudden you have a lot of new traffic. Maybe that means a Meijer store or a Jewel or something like that, because people will stop and grab things on the way home from work. And, you know, you start getting this cycle of build-out that goes along with any kind of development.
What would you say the number is? Is it 1-to-1?
You know, I'd just be guessing.
There have been studies on this. I can't believe I can't remember the number, but it's close to 1-to-1.
1-to-1, or maybe even more.
Might even be more, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think it depends on how much the plant purchases from the outside, too. You know, if you're an assembler, rail cars are pretty much assembled, right? Because you don't make the truck. The truck is the wheel and axle combination. You don't make the seats. You don't make the lights. So you've all of a sudden got business those places too, right?
Yeah.
And now they could be here. They could be somewhere else. But I mean, the discussion last night, and you know, Kevin's a little, he's our maven on Michigan, but he also grew up here. What do you think people's visions are of Chicago? I see people that don't want to come down here because they're afraid. I see people throwing up a $2 million house and knocking down three other houses to put it up, or $4 million. They obviously have a different view of things going forward than the people who won't even come down here because they're afraid they're going to get shot. I mean, is there a chance these people on the south side will get some industry? Or is it just, I can't pay this tax bill, I'm moving to Mississippi? I mean, literally. What are you guys feeling about this? I mean, would you, if you had the scratch-o, would you put up some $1.5 million house and say everything's fine, or you get out of town or somewhere in the middle? I honestly don't know. I've never seen anything like this.
I think if you've got the money to build that kind of a house, you can also, you know, afford a decent car or several decent cars, places to keep them. You don't really have to use public transportation or walk anywhere. If you, you know, don't want to, you certainly don't have to. And I think that's attractive still to people, because there are parts of the city that on the face of it look nice and they're pleasant and they're nice to entertain in, and you're okay living there. But if you are, you know, not in that kind of comfortable stratum of society, and you have to, you know, be on the street and you have to hook it to the bus stop or ride on the L at all hours of the day or night, your you know, formula for what's safe and what's not is entirely different. So I just don't see people who don't have that kind of scratch being magnetized to come to the city at all.
What do you think, Kevin?
I think I would say exactly what John said. It's you can insulate yourself from it if you have a lot of money, and you can do that anywhere. You can do that anywhere in the United States if you want to insulate yourself from all the bad things that could come your way. Maybe not 100%, but you could do it a lot. The question gets to be is, if you're just the average schmuck, are you better off moving to Indiana? Are you better off moving south, moving to Mississippi or someplace like that, where the cost of living is lower and there are, you know, lower crime rates, there are better, you know, better schools. They may not be the best schools in the country, but they're solid top to bottom. And I'm not necessarily, when I use Indiana as an example, you know, it's one thing if you want, and Northwest Indiana's, you know, it's gotten expensive because of the demand for property there. But you could get to, you know, some really nice, you know, a Fort Wayne or someplace like that. That's a nice little city. You can, there's work. There's work that pays well there, and decent schools and a little bit of vision behind what they're doing. And I would say, you know, that all of a sudden starts to look like a good option.
Well, I hate to you know, my usual downer thing, but I think it's all about economics. I mean, I've heard people say, geez, why would anybody live in New York? And and pay $6,000 a month for an apartment. I said, if you're working from Goldman Sachs and you're making $600,000 a year, you're happy to do that. It's all about, you know, what do I think I can make in a certain place? And by the way, if I'm going to work at Goldman Sachs making my 600 big ones, I'll have my little apartment. I have a nice bar down the block. I got a nice. I'm happy.
And if you want to go someplace, you just call down to the front desk. You have them have a cab waiting for you. So you don't have to worry about that. You don't have to worry about standing out on the street hailing a cab or anything like that where you might be exposed. Yeah, you can insulate yourself from it for enough money.
But I mean, here in I have a different a bad view here in Chicago because our office is in what used to be the financial district. And there were probably, how many people, Jen? 25, 30, 50,000 people making a good living in about a 4-square-block area that, for lack of a better term, is all gone. I mean, Citadel moved some of their people to Florida, and plus the money they make, they just, in my opinion, siphon it off everybody else. So you have a few people making all the money. There are all these other people used to make. Now, I guess there's still a lot of law firms. There's still a lot of architecture. But what industries are paying the big dough in Chicago that you can't wait to get into? I know they have some fabulous law firms, and there's a lot of great hospitals. And it's not like the place is falling apart that much. But if you can't, you know, those industries, I mean, who's making $250,000 a year? I'm going to say people that work in these hospitals. Maybe some doctors, but the administrators, some attorneys. I don't know, John. I mean, there used to be people in the financial industry, but how are you gonna fill up all these neighborhoods with people buying houses at $800,000 a pop? If they're not making money somewhere, where are they gonna make the money? I guess my question.
No, you can't. I mean, the example I could think of right off the top of my head is the area of Lincoln Park around DePaul University.
That's where I live, which, as you know.
Yeah. Which has become pretty much, you know, it's a shining light of what you'd like urban life to be. And of course, it's got a price tag attached to it. But the way that neighborhood looked, you know, 50, 60 years ago, it was working class. It, you know, 100 years ago, it was immigrant Irish. And, you know, and very, you know, working class, blue collar, tons of taverns, you know, was like some of the neighborhoods on the southeast side of the city too.
Well, the housing stock is horrible. You know, even a place I live, I mean, it's fixed up, it's nice, but it's horrible. It's 25-foot lots. I mean, who the hell wants a 25-foot lot?
When I lived in Old Town, it's like that too. I mean, it turned into a postcard, like a movie set of, you know, a beautiful neighborhood. But if you kind of tilted your head and picture this, you know, in 1900, it was pretty gritty. And as those neighborhoods have become, you know, refashioned into attractive places for people with a lot of money who can afford, you know, what it takes to keep these buildings up to snuff and to, you know, tear them down occasionally and build even grander places, the city looks like it's working okay. But the people who are the class of people who lived there when the neighborhood was built have moved way far away. There's nothing in the city for that class of people now that I think makes them sustainable as a class or as a large group. There's no really good manufacturing jobs to speak of. If you have a nice white collar job and it requires you to travel on public transportation, there's all sorts of assorted risks attached to that. If you want to drive and you don't have a lot of money and you have to park downtown every day to work somewhere, that isn't workable for
good luck with that.
So I mean, the city has become a, you know, to some extent a playground for people who've got, you know, money to take, you know, advantage of the amenities. Look, I don't know if you know the street Castlewood Terrace on the north side, Tom or Kevin. It's an east-west street right off the lake, where Studs Terkel had a house, you know. And I mean, every house is magnificent. And
like that Hutchinson Street, right?
Yes. Yeah. Even grander.
Though. Even better. Yeah.
And this, you know, everything is this landscape with an adventurous life.
Let me interrupt for a second. But what Jan's talking about is the standard house on the north side was a 25-foot lot, three walk-ups maybe, and then there's a few blocks where all of a sudden everybody's got like 60-foot frontage or 65 or something, and the houses are magnificent, right?
Yeah.
And there's a few blocks like that if you walk north, because I used to walk a real lot. There's a few blocks like that, and some of them got torn down and they put those ugly 4+1s up. But there's still a few blocks that are like that. And you sit there and go, wow, this is in the city?
Yeah. And yet you go two or three blocks from Castlewood Terrace and you're in the teeth of some of the sketchiest parts of Uptown, where, you know, the people on Castlewood Terrace do not, you know, saunter through the rest of the neighborhood on a regular basis, I suspect. They all seem to have pretty nice cars parked in their driveways. You don't have to interact with that part of the city and still live in the, you know, world-class, beautiful place. But the disparity between the people who can do that and the people who can't has just grown over the years. And the people who can afford it don't have any need to move because they can't duplicate that anyplace else, I don't think. But they don't really partake of the city the way most, you know, people who don't have that kind of money have to, and to confront this stuff that is discouraging.
Well, the South
don't experience the city in the same way.
Right, right.
And aren't those some of the neighborhoods, too, that wound up, you know, hiring private security to patrol their areas?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And Castlewood Terrace is a cul-de-sac, so everybody can keep track pretty much of who goes down that street. There's security cameras everywhere. And if you don't know what you're getting into, you know, you could make a fool of yourself. So,
well, the lady used to be on the show with us. Hopefully one of these days she'll come back on. Stephanie Koenig. She,
I remember Stephanie.
Yeah, had the baby as a beautiful young girl, her daughter. I'll still see him once in a while. She's a terrific lady. They live on Larrabee, I think, Jan, or one of the, I think it's, yeah, Larrabee. And it's a pretty nice spot over there. And they have a guy that just circles the block the whole time, private security. I don't know what it costs them. But it's not a development. And all the neighbors, what do you do if all the neighbors want to get together? Do you form an organization, even though it's not really a condominium thing? I mean, what is it? You're the law. How do if everybody on my block decided to, since we just had some guy who knifed somebody a block away the other night, arrested like in front of my house, which is a little shuddering to say the least. If all of a sudden both sides of the street, or two full blocks decided we wanted to hire our own security, how do we do that? I mean, it could be as easy as, I don't think you'd just want to put $100, you know, into a jar every week. You probably want some sign of an organization so they can actually hire the person. What do you even call that?
Well, you got to manage the liability involved with it too. So yes, you would incorporate. You make a homeowners association.
You can just do that.
You could do that, and actually, Lori Lightfoot and Brandon Johnson have told the businesses in North Michigan Avenue pretty much as you should be doing this. It isn't the police department's responsibility to be, you know,
police
pursuing thefts.
What exactly is the police department's responsibility these days? Just out of curiosity.
Well, I don't think you'll get a straight answer if you ask anybody in the police department.
Yeah, well, this morning they had the Stevenson closed for 4 hours at least on a shooting, and I'll bet if we went over there we'd find 25 people. Yet we could drive the Stevenson up and down all day and never see a squad car. Don't you think a little ounce of prevention here might? And what exactly are they looking for 4 hours? I don't get it. I mean, I'm sure that's something I don't understand. But all of a sudden,
the sad thing is, for all the time spent, you know, shutting down expressways and looking for evidence, there's so few arrests made per incident, let alone convictions based on the evidence, that I wonder, you know, is this energy even being well spent at that level? If they can't have a better track record for showing that they can get tough on this stuff, it doesn't seem like it's going to have any kind of effect at the other end of discouraging people from doing it. So I don't know if this is all worth the hassle.
Well, we have an expressway shooting, what, like every second or third night it averages?
Yeah.
You would think that you would just want to have about 30 unmarked cars on the expressway, and when somebody does it, you either arrest them or shoot them or something. I mean, no one's saying just open fire on people, but if they don't stop, I mean, what could be more dangerous than people randomly shooting guns out of a car? I mean, at least in the old movies, the guy in the stagecoach knew how to shoot, right?
Right.
I mean, at least in the movies they did.
You watch Tales of Wells Fargo, and everything seems to happen according to, you know, some intelligent design. Who's in the line of fire and who isn't?
Hey, you know, I got to...
distressing moments, but
talk about isn't that way in real life? Talk about a light note. I was reading something yesterday about Harrison Ford. He's still alive, right? I mean, he just made a movie.
Yeah.
When he went to Hollywood, he went on a bus of all these young people going to Hollywood. They were moving to Hollywood. I mean, he was on like the Greyhound, the Hound. And he said all these people that he was going to do something else for a while. So he got an apartment, and he fixed up his apartment. He got really into carpentry, started taking all these classes in woodworking, became pretty much a master carpenter. And once in a while, he'd get a bit part. And so he was an actor, but he basically was doing carpentry work for people. And he was doing it for some of the big shots in the industry. And who was the producer of... Star Wars. Was it Coppola? No.
Lucas.
Evidently, he was putting a portico on Lucas's house. And Lucas says, "Hey, I hear you're an actor." He goes, "Yeah, well, hey, come read for me this part in this new movie of mine." There's like 300 people, and he ended up getting the part of Han Solo because he was doing carpentry for the guy's front porch. I never heard that. Did you?
The rest is history.
Yeah, I mean, he must have already been in American Graffiti, right?
Oh yeah, with Dreyfuss and also.
Yeah, that's where he got his start, right? When his first movie.
Yeah.
God, what a great
flick! He's from Chicago, I think.
I got to have you guys over sometime. We need to watch that one again. What a great flick, huh? What great music. Kevin could have been the Wolfman if he would have put a beard on in those days. Or
yeah, I doubt, you know, back in those days, yeah, I was not quite as large.
Oh, God.
I'm larger, Kevin. Don't be ashamed.
So just in terms of, is this a...
Hey, I am who I am. You yeah. know? I've long ago accepted that.
So, Kevin, what is this deal with the Supreme Court? They're done now, and then they take like a month or two off, they come back and start hearing cases again? Or what is their schedule?
Yeah.
But they're done. All the rulings are out, right?
Yeah, I think they cleared their docket for the year.
What was it? It has to be one of the busiest years ever, isn't it, for those guys?
Certainly one of the most consequential. I mean,
yeah.
they had like 60 cases on this docket. So, you know, we heard about the most, the ones with the greatest political angles to them. But there were a lot of cases, and some of them were significant. And it's interesting to watch the consensus on the court, because there's a whole lot of consensus that they have, and even their split decisions are, you know, there's a lot more 5-4s than you realize, and even the January 6th one about, you know, applying the law, Amy Coney Barrett went with the liberal justices, and Ketanji Brown Jackson went with the conservative justices on that one. It was still a 6-3, but it was a very interesting split on the 6-3.
Well, don't they have, out of the 60, the ones you don't hear about, say 35 or 40, aren't a lot of those 8-1, 9-0?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, what would those be? Just whether it even, just, I mean, it would, what would be an example of one of those, John? Just something that, you know, just doesn't have any standing whatsoever, or what?
Well, but where there's a, you know, they always try to attack issues that are ambiguous or are likely to breed more and more divergent, you know, wild variations among jurisdictions. So they try to, but they look for cases where that's a possible outcome if they don't do something. So it's really about clarifying stuff that is likely to be litigated frequently, and to do it in a way that will, you know, it takes the onus off of them, of course, ultimately too, but it also makes for more predictable outcomes in the lower courts, so that there isn't a kind of monster that's afoot somewhere, and you've got, you know, all the circuits going in opposite directions and not following any, you know, clear direction. So it's really about giving some standardization, I think, to lawsuits filed at a national level, and I really think that's one of the driving forces when they choose, you know, which ones to grant certiorari to. It's about, you know, making life easier down the road for plaintiffs, defendants, and lawyers, and judges. So not just to get entangled in esoteric stuff, but there is a method to what they do, I think.
Well, I know.
Also, I tend to think that there's a lot of legal consensus when it comes to property rights, when it comes to how commerce is conducted, those kinds
right.
of things for the
right.
most
those
part.
Those transcend the judicial districts, and that there isn't any reason there should be any wide variation for a lot of those issues. Right.
Well, I know I'm way out on, we're a little over here, but that's okay because we started a little late. I know I'm way over my skis here, but the Southside Catholic boy and me, when they come out with a decision like this Chevron thing, I just would like to see somebody, since it's been 40 years the other way, and all of the three of us can talk, and Lou can even do more, can talk about an amazing amount of overreach that Congress never intended virtually in every area of your life. I would like
yes.
to see somebody in the presidential office going, you know what? These guys are right about this. Why don't we go through our departments and find out the most egregious acts we're doing and get rid of them? But I know that's not going to happen.
Kind of self-reflection is not part of.
We're not about to do anything like that. Or the guy who lobbed the one out I talked about earlier about the people having to hire people now to be experts on heat exhaustion. I mean, the person who lobbed that one out there never even thought for a second about this Supreme Court decision, did he?
I don't think so. And look, I think back at the time of the Chevron decision, there probably was less, Congress was less inclined to rely on the agencies to make law. But as we've gotten away from that time and moved down the road from it, Congress has been more than willing to
yeah.
just say, here's your yes. outline, have at it. And Congress needs to get back to doing its own damn job.
I would agree. In my lifetime, are we ever going to reverse the baseball decision? No.
No, I don't think so.
Anyway. Well, thank you, guys.
Who's going to sue?
I'd like to, but I...
hard to say if you have standing or not, even as a ticket holder. But
I'm not even a ticket holder anymore.
If there's a lawsuit over it that challenges the exemption, it's going to come out of labor negotiations.
We don't think it's going to come out of a team that wants to be within 40 miles of a place and can't do it or something. Maybe.
Don't know. I'd have to look at the.
I don't know what. Anyway, thank you guys. Friday, Kevin, we're going to have Mike on with us talk about the soccer stuff. Did we just get our ass kicked in the, when I say we, the U.S. and the Americas tournament? We're out already?
Yeah, they lost one and nothing at the end.
We're out, right? Already?
Yeah.
We were in because we're the host and now we're out?
Yeah.
that didn't last long. Anyway, Mike will bring us up to speed. Happy Nation's Birthday, everybody, tomorrow.
Happy 4th to all of you.
The market closes at 12 today, so don't be trying to trade at 2. Nobody will trade with you. SP Futures down 7, NASDAQ Futures down 43. Back on Friday, Stocks and Jacks.
That's all, folks.